Welcome to the fifth episode of the Sundance 2023 season of the Seventh Row podcast. Sundance runs from January 19th to 29th, 2023. Today, we'll be discussing Eileen, Fairyland, Sometimes I Think About Dying, and other films we've seen so far. I'm Alex Heaney, editor-in-chief of Seventh Row, and this is my 10th year covering Sundance.
I am Ola Smith, the executive editor of Seventh Row, and this is my 4th year covering the festival.
Sundance marks the beginning of the new film year as a festival made up primarily of world premieres. In this podcast season, we'll be talking both about the films we see at the festival and how the films this year fit into the context of the history of the festival's programming.
Mm-hmm. And the last few days have been a mixed bag.
We've seen a lot of bad films, like some that are so bad we're like, should we even mention them?
Can yes, we be and, bothered? and to be clear, these episodes will be coming out several days after they're actually recorded. So if you see us raving about films on Twitter in real time,
yeah,
know that we are stuck in the past in a bit of a slump.
Yeah. And we're going to save the discussion of some of the bad films for later.
Yeah.
Until like, we've both seen them, like Cat Person.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I can't attest to it being bad, but I trust that it is. And
you
I will be watching it.
Shocked if you like it.
Okay. But yeah, I mean, I think there are a few films up top that like we don't really want to link on.
We just want to say that they were, well, I guess you liked one of them.
Did I?
Didn't you like
Mutt?
Oh,
yes, I did. I like Mutt. Yes. Well, I guess let's start there. Mutt, I liked Fine Enough. It's in the US dramatic competition, I think, and it's about a trans man in New York City navigating a day in the life, you know, interacting with people from his past, like his estranged sister, his estranged father, his
a lot of estrangement.
Yes, his estranged, I suppose, ex-boyfriend from before he came out. And it's, you know, it's very Sundance. but I will give credit to the film that when it began, I basically said to myself, I was like, you know, the boyfriend shows up, like all these things happen. I'm like, okay. And I practically said out loud to myself, and then this is going to happen at the end. And by that point, you know, like this character will have, and I really felt like I knew the cliches this was going to follow because so many Sundance-y films do. And I think actually the film really self-consciously does subvert some things in a way that felt quite refreshing. Like this boyfriend appears, and the boyfriend previously, you know, thought he was in a relationship with a woman, and then our main character came out as a trans man and they haven't really talked since, and you assume that the blow up was very much just like a gay panic thing, or like, or him not being able to accept that he's trans or whatever, but it turns out actually that the thing that ended their relationship was a lot more complicated and not just one-sided. Hmm. And I thought that was really interesting, although I really think the film kind of picks it up and drops it a little bit, and it could have been really interesting to explore kind of the character, our main characters of an unreliable narrator. But I do appreciate a lot of the ways that the film subverted cliché. The dialogue can also be like pretty stilted at times and very writerly, like I am writing a screenplay. But yeah, I'd say it is worth checking out, maybe not urgently, but certainly not the worst that the US dramatic competition has to offer.
Oh boy. But the big news of it is Henry Gamble's in it.
Henry Gamble, like, shouted Henry Gamble at my TV. this actor, Cole Doman, well, he looked really familiar in the film. He plays the ex-boyfriend. And I was like, who is this guy? And I looked it up, and he's Henry Gamble from Henry Gamble's Birthday Party. And we love Henry Gamble. So that was a really pleasant surprise.
I actually did that when I watched Cassandra. I went, it's taco with a K, not a C. Like, you look like you think it might be with a C, but it's with a K. That's from Girls.
Memorable. Love to talk to my screen in the middle of a virtual Sundance 20 films in. And also, Matt has like a, there's like a, well, I was talking to a friend of the podcast, Fiona Underhill, about how many movies this year, like a big theme is periods.
Oh, yeah.
So you have, so far I've seen, I think periods
are kind of a, bingo. Because yeah. There's like first period in Fancy Dance, there's period sex in Fair Play.
Polite Society, like one of the ways that they manage to get through like guards in Polite Society is by like telling the guard, oh, I have to get through because like the bride, you know, I need to bring her this tea because, you know, she is that time of the month. And the guard is like so flustered that he lets them in because he doesn't want to ask questions about periods. So periods are like a breaking in and entering device in Polite Society.
Thomas and Mackenzie's character shouts, well, at least I have a time of the month.
But Mutt actually like has a really, really similar period dynamic, am I gonna say that, to Fancy Dance, because it's in the section of the film where the main character's estranged, as said, young 13-year-old sister is hanging out with him in the day, and then the sister gets her first period and he has to kind of like help her through that experience, and it becomes like a moment of bonding between them when they have quite a tense relationship to start with. So you have in both those films the kind of dynamic of like older character and a younger relative having their first period. So periods are really front of the mind of the Sundance programmers this year.
So speaking of Taco with a K, that is a character played by Roberta Colindres, who shows up in Cassandra, a film about lucha libre wrestling, which is like a form of Mexican wrestling. I honestly could not care less about anything related to wrestling, but I watched this movie because Gael Garcia Bernal always delivers. And it's a movie in which Gael Garcia Bernal delivers. Screenplay is like pretty blah. It's kind of like, he wasn't closeted, but then when he took on playing an Exotico character, which is like, I guess they have different kinds of characters in Lucha Libre, and one of them is, I don't know, I guess flamboyant? They don't really explain what it is, but he kind of dresses up in a more flamboyant way. He kind of finds another side to himself that's part performance, but maybe also like a part that he'd been repressing. Yeah, it's kind of just about his rise, that once he does that, he then becomes famous, and you watch that happen, which is not very interesting, but, you know, Gael Garcia Bernal, like, what can't this man do? I really don't know that there's anything this man can't do, including rocking another bad hairstyle.
And similarly, what ways can a movie continue to underuse Raul Castillo? Many ways.
He shows up for a hot minute to be Cassandra's boyfriend, or as his real name is Saul's boyfriend, but like his closeted boyfriend who's actually married and they have to keep it a secret. And the Raul Castillo's character plays the top. He's sort of a jerk to sell because he's closeted and worried about losing his kids and his wife. And that's kind of, not much else happens with him. There's a sex scene.
Someone should give him a good role again.
Somebody really should give him a good role again. I will say
Andrew Hay, get in here.
I know. If only he liked working with the same actors multiple times. Like, he should write a...
only Tom Courtney gets the privilege.
Yeah, well, like, you could give Raul Castillo a nice, like, supporting role. in something.
Yeah.
I will say it's a step up from Roger Ross Williams's last film, which I did not like. Life Animated. Actually, did not like would be an understatement. Didn't hate Cassandra, so there you go.
What else have we seen? I saw Polite Society, the new plucky British comedy. It was fine. It has it's like, again, my thing I'll say about it is I think it does the tone that it's trying to do, and that tone is not for me. People have said that it's like Scott Pilgrim versus the World, and I would say that that's pretty accurate, and I don't like that film. So if you do like that film, there's a good chance that you'll have a lot of fun with this. But I didn't love it. There's some weird, this is always fun to think about in British films, there's some weird class stuff in the film, which was the thing that I like kept bugging me throughout. First of all, like, they go to a private school, the main character, but it's not really, like, mentioned. I only know that because at some point one of her parents is, like, makes some offhand comment about, you know, how hard they work to put them in that school or whatever. But, like, nobody who goes to the school, like, has, like, a posh accent, which you would, like, at least some people would have. It just seems like a normal school.
They didn't have it going in. They would have it coming out.
Yeah, and it has, like, the sex education syndrome of portraying, like, British schools where, like, everything looks like how American high schools are portrayed in a way, except they have uniforms, but the uniforms are, like, not look like, don't look at any uniform I've ever seen in a British school.
Do they also have grade 12 instead of, like, fifth form?
We don't get into that, but I'm sure that they would. And also they have 16-year-olds driving and owning cars, which is also seems like a very American thing. And, like, there's also, like, a bunch of guns in the movie, which I know, like, can exist in England, but it just, like, makes me feel like I'm watching an American film when people just, like, have guns around. And the main character, like, I think the film is trying to talk about class to some extent, because the main character's sister is marrying this guy who is, like, mega rich. Like, they live in, like, a mansion. And so in the film, the main characters are positioned as, like, the poorer family who are marrying up. But it's like, and even though I know that it's true in comparison to this guy, it's so funny to watch it. Because I have so much house envy for them. Like, they live, like, right near Shepherd's Bush, which is, like, pretty, like, towards the, you know, it's not on the very outskirts of London. And they have, like, a really big suburban house. Like, they have a lovely, lovely house. And as someone who is, like, thinking about where I'm going to be living in 4 months and constantly stressing about that, I would be like, I would be happy to live in just one room of your house. Your house must be so expensive. So that was what I was thinking about when I was watching Polite Society. It's fine to me. I'm sure it will find its audience.
Theater Camp, which we both saw. Yeah. Neither of us really liked it, I don't think.
No, it has a couple moments.
It has a good, like, last 10 minutes when you actually get to see them put on the show that they've been doing throughout the film.
And, yeah, but it's not bad.
It's just good enough.
Yeah,
you know, it's
if I was one of those parents going to the theater camp final show, and I would be expecting to be, like, bored, I would be, like, pretty pleased with what they gave me at the end there.
Yeah, as someone who was a musical theater camp kid for many, many, many years, I can't say I saw any of my experiences reflected on screen, aside from that I know some of those songs, and yes, we sang them at theater camp. Yeah, it's just, like, kind of, like, two-dimensional and not very funny and trying to be funny.
It can't decide if it wants the characters to be two-dimensional with the intent of going for something more absurdist, or if it wants them to be real people we care about, and it kind of flip-flops between the two. And it then, like, at the end, it expects us to care about them when it hasn't done any of the work to set that up. And it kind of has very little structure.
It has things that are supposed to be like theater inside jokes, but they're like as inside as tar jokes are. Like, if you've ever been, like, if you've ever listened to classical music, there's nothing insidery about it. It's just like the difference between you've listened to some classical music and you haven't. And like, this is like, have you ever heard of a musical theater show? Then you know who Kander and Ebb are. That's not like a funny thing. And that's kind of where this film sits. Like, they didn't even have interesting commentary about, like, say, what audition song people chose to sing and what that says about them. It's just...
I think some of the jokes in isolation hit. Some of them are like, delivered pretty well. I mean, I don't think the actors are doing a bad job.
No, it's just formless.
Formless is the word.
It was done through improvisation, and yeah, you can tell. Like,
yeah,
you can,
I mean, some
do improvisation well and then edit it, but maybe they didn't actually get enough good material to.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know.
As someone who has watched a lot of mumblecore films, you need to take the right lessons from that kind of approach to making a film, which is you need to like make sure that you have a very solid structure to improvise within, and this movie doesn't particularly. It does feel like it was sort of thrown together from like people being like, oh, this is funny, I'll do that quickly, oh, this is funny, and some of it's funny, but it doesn't string together at all, so it just kind of, you kind of feel lost in the middle of this big sludge. All of our episodes are carefully curated so that we only discuss films we think are really worth your time and deserve in-depth critical analysis. We tend to dedicate episodes to thought-provoking, under-discussed films that no other podcast would cover with such depth. We've talked in this episode about a few of the films or topics that we've covered in such episodes, like Leave No Trace, starring Thomasin McKenzie, and our episode on Angels in America adaptations, as well as our episode that tackles a brief history of AIDS on screen. To listen to all of our episodes, become a member today. You'll also get a discount in our shop to purchase our books from filmmakers like Celine Siama, Kelly Reichardt, and Joanna Hogg, all of whom have screened at Sundance. To become a member, go to 7th-row.com/join.
Shall we talk about Sometimes I Think About Dying, which was a film we both liked and I was hotly anticipating because I had seen, heard about, I think when we recorded the episode, I'd heard about Rachel Lambert's debut, and I think that evening I watched her debut, which features a great Maren Ireland, who we'll come back to when we
hit she's Eileen. In that.
Yeah.
And so this is a strange case, Sometimes I Think About Dying, because it is a film based on a short, which is, you know, common, but it's, the short film was not directed by Rachel Lambert.
Yeah.
The short film was directed by another person who is the former director of the, one of the writers in the film is the person who directed the short film, but she did not direct this, Rachel Lambert did, and I feel like it seems what happened there is a writer was like, I'm not the best person to direct my script. And don't we always say that more writers should do that or the other way around?
It's usually directors that shouldn't write. Usually the writers that direct are like late in their career, like Martin McDonagh, and have a big ego and decide they're directors now.
Yeah, I mean, I also think you see a lot of, like, first-time writer-directors at festivals like Sundance who don't know how to kind of... I mean, maybe their scripts are bad, too. Maybe their scripts are all right. Who knows? But they certainly, most of them, don't know how to, like, block a scene. And the thing about this film is Rachel Lambert really does know how to make a film. This is really formally well-executed, thoughtful... I was wary of it at first, especially before you told me that Rachel Lambert was a bit more of a known quantity, because it does look like it could be so Sundancey. It's called Sometimes I Think About Dying. It's you get afraid that that's going to be like, isn't this quirky? And the movie really pleasantly surprised me because, like, it's really not like that. It's very understated, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean, it's like 20 minutes into the film before we find out that Daisy Ridley is going to speak and in an American accent.
Yeah, she really doesn't talk a lot.
I think what I really liked about it, I mean, is, like, it's about this woman who's kind of lonely and isolated, and Rachel Amber is really good with her sound design and her blocking framing. And framing to really make you feel how this woman is surrounded by other people at work, but that only makes her feel more and more alone.
Yeah.
And as she sort of starts to open up a little bit toward the end of the film, a little bit being the operative word here, mm-hmm. like the nature of those background sounds just sort of like starts to change a little bit, and they feel a little bit warmer as opposed to like quite so harsh and unpleasant. It's like the difference between office chatter where you like want to kill yourself and literally she does think about dying and imagine various ways of killing herself. And then later it's sort of like more of a feeling of, oh, there's kind of some community around me.
Yeah. And it captures an office so well. Like she lives in Oregon, right? In a more kind of remote part of Oregon. Which, by the way, for a film about Sometimes I Think About Dying, about a depressed person, I found like the opening like 15 minutes of this film kind of so soothing in a way, because it actually looks really nice to live there.
Yeah, well, Oregon's nice. It's everywhere in the Pacific Northwest is nice.
Yeah, and you get a lot of like, you know, slow shots of the environment, and I'm like, I could do with a little time spent here. Oh, like a place where you can have an office job and afford like a decent home where you live by yourself. I like to live there. But yeah, I don't know. It's the office itself is just like, I think they work in some kind of like administration for shipping.
Yeah, you know, they're the port authority for the tiny town that they live in.
Yes, so they're like right by the ocean, it's a very like plain, dingy office. But like, she's populated this office with like really good character actors who
they feel like people who could be in a Soderbergh film.
Yeah, they are so like mundane in the kind of chatter they have, but so real and so idiosyncratic. Each of the people in the office you really get to know, and you really get to know like the type they are. They all feel really distinct.
Well, and they look like real people.
They look like real people, and there's really funny bits, like when they have a new person in the office and they all have a meeting and they all have to go around and say their name and their favorite food, and each of their answers is really funny in their own ways, including Fran's, which is, I'm Fran, I like cottage cheese, which no one's favorite food is cottage cheese except for Fran. I like, she does such a good job of creating a world and a mood, and this script is quite simple, but it's like, and I think in another director's hands, the simplicity and straightforwardness of the script could feel like, could make for quite a boring film. But because Rachel Lambert creates this world that feels so real, I was perfectly happy to kind of live within it and follow Fran within it. And she completely elevates the material.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think Daisy Ridley is really good in it as well. Like, I mean, again, like she's surrounded by very skilled character actors, mm-hmm. and she's more of a star. But this is a part that, again, if it had been played with more quirks, could have come across really grating. But she really, really like, underplays the role and sells Fran as quite a thoughtful person, even though she is very quiet and very withdrawn and very unsure of how to ingratiate herself socially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's kind of it seems like unexpected casting, but it's actually kind of smart casting, because you think about what made her good in Star Wars was it's not really the speaking parts, it's all the stuff in between and the ability to like embody the character. And I think this movie really makes use of that. That's, you know, it's worth recognizing that that's a skill and that that's what she brings to the film.
And actually Sundance is like full of like British actors who look kind of like Daisy Ridley. I'm referring to Emilia Jones and Emilia Clarke. And I think Daisy Ridley shows herself to be, of all the She's Daisy Ridley the types, best the most actually them. Skilled.
Yeah. My one issue with the film is also an issue I had with Rachel Lambert's first film, In the Radiant City, which is she tends to like to make films about these sort of like vague central characters, and I think she doesn't want to make choices about them because she wants them to seem, she like wants to live in that ambiguity, which is often a good idea, but I still felt like I didn't really know Fran by the end, and like part of that's because Fran doesn't know who she is, but it like that's a problem in sometimes I think about sorry not this this is sometimes I think about dying that's also a problem in The Radiant City, where it's about this these two brothers, one of them is in prison and for doing something horrible, and his brother snitched on him, and it's about the brother coming back home to their small town after 20 years to go to his brother's trial, and the family wonders whether they can get this estranged brother to speak in favor of the incarcerated brother. And the film never really answers the question of like, why did he do it or how does he feel about it? Instead, it raises questions that I'm not sure she was intending to raise, like, did they both do it and one of them took the blame? And so like there's a lot of great atmosphere and you're like really drawn in and want to know more about these characters, but I feel like both films kind of keep you at a bit of a remove from these characters in a way that I found a bit frustrating. And that might be more a script thing, and she did co-write her first feature, but she didn't write this one, but it seems like it might also be like an interest of hers, like trying to have vague characters. And I don't necessarily think that you have to have characters who have clear-cut ideas, but sometimes I felt it was a bit alienating in both of her films. So I'm curious to see where she goes next, because I think she gets really great actors and gets really great performances out of them, or even gets great performances out of actors you didn't necessarily know were great. And like you said, she's really, really, I think she's a really great visual stylist, really skilled at sound and image and blocking and framing, and you don't see that a lot. Her films don't look like anybody else's films. All right, speaking of the Pacific Northwest,
Fremont.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to talk about, even though you haven't seen this film, Alex, it's one of my favorites of the festival so far, and I found it to be quite a good double bill with Sometimes I Think About Dying. I mean, I watched them one day and one the next. Because they're both, first of all, they're like exactly the same length, for reasons that work for both films, a tight 90 minutes.
Yeah.
Which is always nice.
Yes.
And
they've been, you know, the 90 minute films have had a higher batting average this year than the 2 hour plus films.
Yeah.
There's a reason for it.
Most of the 2 hour plus films, I've wondered, why is this 2 hour plus?
Yep.
So this is also a character study about a very isolated young woman who doesn't really speak to a lot of people or have many strong relationships, who is, I think the film also is reluctant to fill in details about her character in the same way that is true about sometimes I think about dying, although we do, I think we learn maybe slightly more about her background through scenes where she's in talking to a psychiatrist and he is really, you know, trying to get information out of her that she is very unwilling to give. But this film is, it has a, it's about a young woman of about 24 called Donya, who is from Afghanistan, and she came to Fremont, California 8 months previously and has been working in a fortune cookie factory. And she, to start the movie, she just is working, like, packaging up the fortune cookies, and she has a friend who she does it with, who's kind of one of her only friends. And then she gets promoted to the person who writes the fortunes, which is very exciting. And she, we kind of just follow the rhythms of her life. The film is shot in black and white, and it has a very odd tone. It's kind of very deadpan and slightly surreal in the way that dialogue is delivered and the way that people act. Not totally surreal, but slightly heightened, which just kind of serves to highlight her alienation, I suppose. And it took me a while to get used to the way that the film was pitching itself to me, but it really, I think, eventually settles in and it really works. So we see her at the fortune cookie factory, we see her spending time with her one friend who works at the fortune cookie factory, we see her regularly going to a restaurant run by an Afghan man who she talks to and watches soap operas in their language, and then we see her at the motel where she lives talking to some of the other immigrants who work there, and then we see her, she can't sleep, and all she wants is a prescription for sleeping pills. But in order to get them, she has to actually talk to a psychiatrist, which she doesn't want to do. And so we see their repeated conversations, and he is very funny. And he's played by Greg Turkington, who is also one of those people whose face you'll probably recognize, but whose name you probably don't know.
Yeah, who was in a bunch of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Film by Rick Alverson, who I interviewed about that film.
Yes, and I think he was in the comedy as well by Rick Alverson.
Yeah, he was.
And yes, he's like his performance is very funny. He tries many different methods by which to get through to her, such as like showing her his favorite book, which is White Fang by Jack London. He says, "This is my favorite story about an immigrant." And then he tells her the entire plot of White Fang, and he can't stop himself from crying at the end. And she is very unmoved. And then she gives him one of her fortune cookies, and he spends about a minute struggling to unwrap it. And then he decides he's going to write his own fortunes and try to read them to her to see if she finds them very profound, and she doesn't particularly. But we've kind of all those different circumstances I mentioned, we see them repeated again and again throughout the film as her routine circles back on itself and repeats and repeats. And we just get the sense of her as this character who is kind of exhausted by life and recovering from her past. She was a translator in Afghanistan, working for the US, and she basically became a translator so that she could emigrate, and the other translators she worked with were killed, and she says she's lucky and they were unlucky. And you get the sense that she feels a lot of guilt, and she feels very depressed, obviously, about what she's been through, but she is insistent that she isn't struggling and that she's only needs sleeping pills and that's it. And she's kind of very resistant to explore the difficult feelings she has. So she just lives this repetitive and very disconnected life. And then she decides to send out a message in one of the fortune cookies, basically like with her name and her number, hoping that somebody interesting will decide to call her and her life can be shaken up a bit. And it doesn't exactly go to plan, but she does end up having a very interesting encounter in the third act with Jeremy Allen White, who is the internet's new boyfriend after the bear. And it kind of ends in a place that is quite lovely and lightly hopeful, but not in a treacly way and not in an unrealistic way. I know, it's a film that I've thought about a lot.
This is our second podcast season about a film festival. You can catch up with our Women at Cannes season from May 2022, where we focus more on the history of the Cannes Film Festival and its track record, or lack thereof, for programming films directed by women. You can find out all about that season at 7th-row.com/womenatcannes. That's SEVENTH-ROW.com/womenatcannes. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. You can also scroll back in your podcast feed to our first season and you will find our Women at Cannes season there.
So I think Eileen was one of our most anticipated films of the festival, just because, it features and slashes made by a few known quantities. Mm-hmm. It's directed by William Oldroyd, who is somebody I am/was, you know, slightly on the fence about. He directed Lady Macbeth, which is his first film, which is a film that is not, which is very competently directed, but is not a film I liked.
Yeah.
Mainly for script reasons, but obviously a director can be held slightly at fault.
Good performances made Florence Pugh a star.
Exactly. So he knows how to direct actors. That's one thing we know. And it's been a while, but this is his second film, finally Eileen, which is a film based on a novel by one of the internet's other favorites, Otessa, how do I say her name? Mushfeg?
Yeah, that would be my guess.
Yes, who has written a bunch of books like My Year of Rest and Relaxation, which is also being made into a film. That Eileen is, I believe, the first adaptation of her work. Yeah. And it is set in the 1960s and follows a young woman called Eileen, who's played by Thomasin McKenzie, who is one of our favorites. And who actually broke out at Sundance several years ago with Leave No Trace, which he wrote a book on.
I hadn't realized Otessa Moshfegh wrote Causeway.
Yeah, I don't think she originated it, but I think they brought her on board at some point in the process for that script. And I think
it's the same team. Luke Goebbels. Yeah,
the guy who wrote. I think Causeway had more than two writers.
Yeah,
it had three.
I think
one of those was the person who kind of originated. I don't know, but I think at some point they brought her on, and I guess this is her writing
and
partner.
And Luke Goebel, who also did Eileen.
So yeah, so it's the two of them writing, William Oldroyd directing, and basically it follows Eileen, who works at a prison. It's the 1960s. It's New England, and a new employee enters the prison who is a psychologist, who is played by Anne Hathaway. And Eileen becomes infatuated by her, and then something unexpected happens about an hour into the film, which is about 90-ish minutes long.
Mm-hmm. Involving Maren Ireland.
Oh, she is in the film before that, but then she appears again in an unexpected way. And there are a few other people in the film. Owen Teague is in a couple shots. We liked him in Montana Story in 2021. And Shea Whigham, King of Sundance, is back.
Bad
Dad's
at Sundance.
Yes, he was in Fancy Dance playing a bad dad. He plays bad dad in this film as well. And I don't know, because it's certainly one of the best directed films of Sundance. And it's certainly one of the best acted films of Sundance. And yet, it is not totally satisfying.
No.
Yeah. I was saying to Alex before we recorded that at a certain point, I, f- I felt like we were just about to enter act two, and then I checked and there were like 30 minutes left of the film, like we were an hour in, because she's, you get the sense that there's this growing attraction to Anne Hathaway's character, who invites Thomas and Mackenzie's character Eileen out to drink, and that feels like, you know, the start of like several scenes where these two characters will get to know each other. And then Anne Hathaway disappears, and then like there's at least like half an hour after that, and I cannot remember what happens in that half an hour because none of it is particularly distinct. And then Anne Hathaway appears again and you're like, okay, so this is like the act two of their relationship, and then there's going to be more scenes like that.
Not a lot happened.
And then all the plot happens all at once. So it's, which I think is kind of like what they were going for, but I'm not sure it works.
I mean, you sort of appreciate that you're kind of along for the ride and you don't know exactly where it's going, which is, you know, rare for a Sundance film.
Yeah. Yeah, and I would say what's interesting is that there's one of the most successful films at Sundance this year is Fair Play, and and the one
exactly
line
where you might think it would go.
But the one line everyone used about Fair Play in their initial reactions were that it was like a new great erotic thriller.
What?
And yeah, and even if it's not totally successful as such, I feel like Eileen is,
it's more of an erotic thriller than Fair Play is.
It's much easier to describe this film as an erotic thriller than it is that one. It goes in some unexpected directions in the last act that don't like totally make sense for various reasons. One of the reasons is that Anne Hathaway, while I found her very, very compelling in the film, because we don't really learn much about what motivates her character, her actions in the last third are pretty inexplicable. And
she kind of exists to dazzle and then to drive the plot.
Yes, and she definitely dazzles, but I wish, and I don't think it's Anne Hathaway's fault at all, but I wish the script gave us a little bit more meat on the bone with her character. Whereas the whole thing is experienced through Thomas and Mackenzie's eyes, and I think she's really wonderful in it. Mm-hmm. She really holds the camera, and she's also very kind of withdrawn character, so we spend a lot of time with her on her own, and Thomas and Mackenzie is really compelling to watch.
Great at being quiet, at like, yes, just she's showing everything in her face and her body.
She's really compelling to watch think, mm-hmm. And kind of perceive the world around her. And I feel like...
And to Oldroyd's credit, he gives us time to watch her. Like, there are scenes, yes, that go on for 3 minutes, and it's just watching her think.
Yes,
and
exactly.
And process what's going around her. And that's always a great thing to have when you have an actor who can handle that and a director who's willing to give them that. Mm.
And I feel like this is the most space Thomas and Mackenzie has been given to be, mm-hmm, good in a film since Leave No Trace.
Yeah.
So it's really nice to see that, to be reminded of what a compelling actress she is.
Yeah, she's really fantastic in it. It's kind of, like, it seems like weird casting at first, but it's also another kind of, like, genius piece of casting. Because the character is, like... The idea behind the character, she kind of like looks like a young innocent, but then actually she goes around masturbating on inappropriate places.
I mean, the opening scene is her masturbating in appropriate places.
Yeah, she can like does that in other places too that are much more inappropriate than that.
Like work, for
like
example.
Work in plain sight, not like, mm-hmm, in a room with a closed door.
With a window right behind her.
Yeah, she's like in a public space part of work, not like in a bathroom. And it's kind of, so it ends up working out really well as somebody who's sort of like a little bit socially awkward, which we know she can do before because she did that in Leave No Trace, but somebody who's maybe a bit precocious, but also maybe doesn't really know who she is. Like, these are things that she's done before, but she gets to do it in a new context because it's, like, somebody who's also, it's, like, dealing with weird sexuality things.
Yeah, and like you said, like she appears as a kind of innocent, but there's this darkness beneath it, and the film requires her to kind of have a very brisk turn in the third act, and because Thomas and Mackenzie threads that through, she really sells that turn.
Well, she has to be kind of hungry and ruthless, and you feel both of those things: hungry, ruthless, and yet unassuming.
Yes. The only place where her character kind of loses me is at the very end, because I think the film is just kind of confused about what it's saying.
Yeah.
But Thomas and Mackenzie herself kind of carries us through most of it, making her a very psychologically coherent human being.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird. I'd kind of recommend it, and it's not a terrible watch. It's very well executed, it's very well acted, and
it's a slow burn, though, I feel is worth saying, because like you're just kind of, you're engaged and you're interested, like, who are these people and what's going on and what's going to happen, but I've heard it described also as like a caper, which makes it sound a lot more like a lesbian rom-com caper is how someone described it to me. I think this was secondhand from somebody else, and I would say it is not a rom-com.
I would say it's not a rom-com.
It's not a caper. It's sort of a thriller-ish.
It's like, for the first hour, it is a slow burn drama, and then it becomes a thriller in its final act.
And it's not really a psychological thriller, because it kind of loses sight of the character's psychology, although that happens a lot in psychological thrillers.
And yeah, I can see some hints at kind of what they're trying to say, but I don't necessarily think any of those things felt particularly revelatory for me, and they're not necessarily fully fleshed out anyway.
There's a lot of stuff you spend a lot of time on, and you're like, well, I like this actor, so I'll go with it, and then you kind of at the end you're like, I guess this was set up. Like, I guess that was only there for setup, but didn't really go places with that either.
It's a weird one. And again, I think for pure shock value, the last act is quite entertaining, where I think there are moments when it drags a little bit in the first hour for me, but there is a payoff. But the payoff, when taken as a whole, is not necessarily super satisfying.
Yeah. I think maybe you liked it more than I did. And part of why I hesitate to not recommend it is because it's so nice to see Thomas and Mackenzie doing really great work. I mean,
yeah,
we really loved Leave No Trace. We wrote a book on it called Leave No Trace, a special issue. And Orla, you wrote this really wonderful detailed analysis of her performance in that film. And I feel like a lot of the things that you point out about what she brings as an actor, you really get to see in Eileen. And you and I have been watching every little glimpse of Thomas and Mackenzie we could find in the intervening like 4 years, and being really annoyed that it wasn't much.
I did. What was the one that I skipped? Well, I skipped a few, but the first one I skipped was The King, because apparently she's not in it that much.
I watched that one. I skipped the Edgar Wright movie. I think you saw that one.
I saw that. I had an episode with The King where I asked on Twitter, is The King worth watching just for Thomas and Mackenzie? And then I got an angry DM from a Timothy Chalamet fan being like, you've betrayed Timothy Chalamet. Why would you not watch it just for him? I thought you liked him. I said, no, Thomas and Mackenzie is my new friend.
Well, I tried to block The King out of my memory, but now that you mentioned it, we did actually do an episode on The King where we ripped it to shreds so that you don't have to see it. I suffered. so that yes, you don't
I did
have
not
to.
Do that episode. I did not suffer. And I think you like Anne Hathaway's performance less than I do. I think she's really excellent. I think she's really excellently used here, and I think she kind of she plays charismatic in such an enticing way, but she does offer equally enticing kind of like hints under the surface, and she gets to unravel a little bit, and I found her really compelling, but I also wish that the film was more interested in who her character is, because I think an actress like Anne Hathaway could have done even more with this had there been more to the character.
Yeah, I mean, I think I found her a bit mannered. So sometimes it felt to me like an Anne Hathaway TM performance.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say I didn't find her mannered, but I found her purposefully mannered, I suppose.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
That's how it landed with me.
I'm not sure I agree with that, but I would agree with you that there are a lot of moments where you get to see, where you see like an insight into this character that is maybe not on the page, but that she's bringing. Yeah. So I don't think she's bad, but sometimes it feels like she's playing Kate Blanchett in Carol.
They are definitely performances in conversation with each other. Like, you definitely think about Kate Blanchett and Carol, even just the way she's styled.
Yeah. Although, oh boy, her wig is bad. Yeah, if you want to hear us talk about Leave No Trace, it goes all the way back to episode one of the podcast. Back when we didn't know how to do sound or have proper microphones, but we had passion for the film.
Yeah, we did, certainly.
I guess we want to talk about Fairyland, which, of course, was on our radar, partly because I will watch anything set in San Francisco, because I used to live there for 6 years, and I miss it. And also because we've been thinking a lot on the podcast in the past about depictions of AIDS on screen, like we did in our episode 91, AIDS on Screen. We went through like a whole history of AIDS depictions on film and a little bit of TV. And then we also did an episode comparing two adaptations of Angels in America. So that's episode 98. Those are both members-only episodes. You, if you want to listen to them, you can become a member at 7th-row.com/join. But I think we both, like that, those were both very educational episodes for us because we learned, like we watched just a ton of movies about AIDS in a short period of time. And I'm sure that is part of how we're reflecting on Fairyland, which doesn't handle it so well.
Yeah, I found this one of the most frustrating viewings of the festival because it's not like it, that was, it's a film that, where there's nothing to it. Mm-hmm. There's actually a lot to this film and to the story that, and throughout the film I saw so many opportunities for this to be a more insightful, more interesting film if it had picked up on certain threads that it drops, or if it had taken a keener interest in or a slightly different perspective on the dynamics that it depicts. But it consistently goes for the most kind of generic telling of its story. In a way that is really frustrating to watch. It's about a young girl who is, well, we first meet her played by a child actress who is adorable. And her father, we start the film when her father and her find out that her mother has died in a car crash. So we don't really get to see any of their life with their mother in the Midwest. But as soon as the mother dies, her father, who's played by Scoot McNairy, whisks her off to San Francisco and immediately basically starts to live his life as a gay man. Although the way he describes it later in the film is that he's bisexual, possibly.
It's but pretty vague about it.
He basically only dates men now, post-wife, but he also kind of implies that he was, you know, in love with, well,
it's not, it's very ambiguous.
It's very vague.
like he definitely loved her mother.
But then they started having sex with other people. Or she
And he talks about how he couldn't give her what she needs, which I kind of read as because he's gay.
Yeah.
So, but you know, it's but like the 60s and 70s, you got married and you needed a beard.
Yeah, it's
and if you found somebody you liked and who, you know, was willing to take you on, you did it.
Mm-hmm. So he starts living kind of a life that it seems that he had been yearning to live and now just has the opportunity to live in San Francisco, having sex with many men, doing drugs, and
he goes through so many boyfriends, like an aspirational amount.
Yeah, but he also has like a, you know, she's about six, right?
Yeah.
He has a six-year-old daughter, but that won't stop him. She'll just run around and live her life, and he'll live his life, and he'll parent slightly. And
slightly being the operative word.
And there are some nice things about the way that he brings her up. He brings her up with a certain openness.
Mm-hmm.
But he also...
He doesn't judge her except for when she judges him for being a bad parent, which he often is.
Yes. But the thing about, the way he parents is you just sense that he is a man in arrested development because he is only just now getting to live a life that he wanted to live when he was younger, and he is kind of living at full throttle, despite the fact that that gets in the way of being there for his daughter sometimes, or a lot of the time. And so it's interesting because you do kind of you understand what factors have led him to be the kind of person he is and to act this way, but it's also you're seeing the film from the perspective of his daughter and you're seeing how really it's unfair to her. And he's also a writer and he kind of writes about his life, and she at a certain point when the film flashes forward and we then spend a lot of time with her as a young woman, an older teenager and then a young adult played by Emilia Jones. And there's a scene where like he reads excerpt of his book and she just gets really frustrated with him, and you get the sense that he's kind of like a bit of a self-absorbed writer, and it's a very complicated relationship, and she gets really justifiably angry with him and with the way that he has parented her, and I find that dynamic really fascinating. But I wish the film found it more interesting.
Yeah, the film doesn't seem to recognize that he passive aggressively takes out a lot of his anger at the world on her. And then whenever she takes out her anger on him, occasionally in like a not nice way, like with gay bashing.
Or maybe that's she's not actually gay bashing people. Okay, she just uses a slur.
Homophobic slurs, yeah.
Yeah.
Like she will
not like all the time. Not but all the there's time. A, there's a like, scene where she lashes out using a homophobic slur.
But he lashes out at her all like when he gets AIDS and wants her to take care of him. He's like, I know you don't want to be here, but guess what? I didn't want to be your dad when I became a single parent. And you're like, what the
fuck?
Well,
he doesn't say it like that.
I know he says I wasn't ready to be your dad, but I did it anyway. And it's like, well, you chose to be a parent.
What he says actually that, and the thing that annoyed me about it was that, he wasn't ready to be a single father. He doesn't say he wasn't ready to be a father.
That's
he
true.
Wasn't ready to be a single father, which makes me think, how much parenting were you doing when your wife was alive? Like, were you just not parenting then and now you have no choice? Like,
that's definitely what I took from it.
Because, like, if you are, like, I mean, no one who's in a couple who decides to have a child, you know, like, you don't think that you're going to become a single parent, you know?
Yeah, and obviously that's your partner hard, might die. And I'm certainly not trying to say that he doesn't have the right to, you know, find it.
But he should at least have some experience parenting.
He should have some experience parenting, and it's not her fault. Like this isn't payback. Like the fact that her mother died, there shouldn't be like payback for that, because she was still around and was suddenly his problem. Like, that's not her fault.
But I think what the film does is it treats her anger as just normal, like the way teenagers are always angry at their parents. But it's not. It really is. I don't think it takes her anger seriously.
No.
And I don't think it holds him to task enough, especially in the second half when he is dying from AIDS and she becomes his full-time carer. And there's a scene where he says she's kind of acting kind of stroppy, and he says to her, I know you're angry, but you need to understand that you need to, like, be conscious of the fact that you're angry at AIDS, the disease, and not angry at me, and you need to stop taking it out on me. And I couldn't help but think, like, okay, I feel bad for you because you're dying, but she is angry at you.
Yeah.
Like, she has a right to be angry at you. Like, just because you're dying doesn't mean that her, you know, you haven't actually resolved her anger towards you. And the way the film does resolve it is by him, it is by him kind of saying, yeah, I know I fucked up, but know that I did it nobly, trying to live my life. And I'm like, wait, but you haven't actually apologized.
Well, I mean,
you haven't apologized.
He also takes out his anger about having AIDS on her. Mm-hmm. And, like, after spending most of her childhood being pretty indifferent to her and abandoning her a lot of the time, in ways you shouldn't do as a parent, even as, like, a 60s, 70s parent where it was fine to leave your five-year-old at home by themselves. Like, not only does he do that, but then when she grows up and is, I don't know, maybe suddenly interesting to him, then he gets kind of controlling and he doesn't want her to go away to school, and then he tries to persuade her to move back home. Like, he now suddenly he wants to have control over her, and then, like, his big speech at the end is about how he let her have freedom. And it's like, but you didn't really seem to want to do that when she was an adult. And, like, the film can't really deal with the complexity of the fact that, yeah, that AIDS is really bad. It's really shitty that he got AIDS and that the world didn't care and he was left all on his own, and all he had, the only thing he could do was to ask his daughter to care for him. Like, the film only sees that side of it and not the other side of, like, yeah, but it's also kind of his perfect excuse to get her to come home, like he was trying to do for years. You know, like, if he hadn't already been doing that, then I wouldn't read it that way. But he had already been trying to interfere with her decisions and her attempt to separate herself from him and his life. And she's not allowed to take out her anger on him, but he's allowed to take out his anger about AIDS on her. But also she has justifiable reasons to be angry at him for how he's parented her. And the film is kind of like, yeah, but really she's just angry at, like, homophobia and at AIDS and the patriarchy. And it's like, yes, that's true, and I feel empathy for him. I understand why he's behaving in the way that he is, but that doesn't mean it makes it okay for him to behave that way. It just means that, like, he's been dealt a shitty deck of cards, and I feel for him, and I get that he's going to make mistakes.
Yeah, and I think the film is just, it just seems afraid of the complexity of what if your dad has AIDS, but also he's been a bit of a shitty dad.
Yes.
And you want to resolve that, but you also, you don't, he's at the end of his life.
Yeah.
And it's I think there is a really complex film in here.
Yeah.
If you actually tackled that, if you, like, either had him, I mean, it's based on a true story. I'm curious to read the memoir that it's based on, which is written from her perspective, to see if it has these same problems or not. But it is, I think the film really needed to deal with, like, the reality of how his behavior affected her, even if he didn't get, even if he never kind of apologized while he was alive, or made amends or acknowledged the harm that he had done.
Yeah.
And it actually just ends, like, right after he dies. Like, we don't get to see how she can rebuild her life without him, which I think is would have been a really important part of this story, which is told from her perspective.
And well, and there's nobody in her life there to tell her that she has a right to her anger.
Mm.
Like, instead, it's mostly about how she's been hiding the fact that she has a gay dad, and now she's coming out of the closet. And I say it like that because that's kind of the film draws this weird false equivalence between hiding having a gay dad and being gay, which are not the same things, even if they may both be, like, traumatic in different ways. But, like, I guess because of that, we never get to really see her have an actual confidant or any way of dealing with things. So instead, we just get a bunch of unnecessary speeches from her father, played by Scoot McNairy. Like, we get an unnecessary speech about how he was oppressed and now he's, like, reclaiming his life. It's like, yeah, I figured that out from the way you're behaving like a 16-year-old. Mm. And, you know, lots of speechifying, not a lot of, yeah, like, real reflection.
Yeah, and I think, like, I think Scoot McNairy is good.
Yeah, yeah, he is. It's not, yeah, it's not his fault he's been asked to deliver a bunch of bad monologues. Yeah.
I think he's maybe, I think he gives the strongest performance in the film.
For sure.
And I think he brought as much as he could to the role. I just wish that character had been explored in a different way.
Yeah.
I think he really could have, you know, he could have excelled with stronger material as well.
Yeah.
Theme
and, of the festival.
Yeah.
Good actors and it's another caught in bad screenplays.
And it has, there's a bunch of, like, names in supporting roles, but none of them are given particularly meaty or interesting stuff to do. Like, Gina Davis is there for a bit, but only for a bit. And
the progeny of Charlotte Gainsbourg and, yeah, Yvonne Attal, who sweeps Amelia Jones off her feet when she goes to study abroad in Paris.
He's fun. He looks like a bookshop or something. He's like, I like it. It's very socialist, or something.
I think it's the book that she's reading or something.
Yes.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, he's like richer than God.
Well, he's the progeny of Charlotte Gainsbourg.
Well, of course. But yeah, it's and then Amelia Jones is kind of one of the stars of Sundance this year with this in Cat Person, and it's interesting because she was obviously like a hot new thing with Coda, and I thought she was really excellent in that film.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't seen Cat Person yet. I know you have thoughts. I think in this film, I felt she was off and on for, yeah, me. I especially towards the beginning, I kind of wasn't really sure about her performance. I think she plays the stuff when she's a carer for her dad quite well. I think she kind of portrays just the kind of oppressive cloud of depression that, mm-hmm, she's under quite well.
Yeah.
But I don't think she's on like super sure feet throughout the film.
Yeah.
So I think the jury is kind of still out on Amelia Jones. I think she is perhaps promising, but I'm not totally sure of the extent of her skills.
So many films so quickly.
Mm. Yeah.
She's kind of the same in Cat Person. Although the script for that is so bad that I don't know how much you can blame her for not being better.
Yes, tune into one of our future episodes for a more thorough beating of Cat Person.
Alongside Fair Play.
Yeah. Which will be less thoroughly beaten, I think, but still given a little bit of a wrap up. Okay, well, this is our favourite segment of the Sundance podcast, which is Sundance Bingo. So in all of our wrap-ups, we are going through the Sundance Bingo card, which you can find a link to in the show notes so you can play along.
Yeah, it's, I've updated it since like our first episode because I spotted some typos and things.
Mm-hmm. So we have been just ticking off, because and I think the bingo card, what it does is highlight the fact that every year there are some very predictable programming trends in the Sundance program, and it's very easy by just putting a couple of those tropes on the bingo card to get a line pretty quickly. I've not got a line yet.
I've not got a line yet, but I've got quite a few 3 or 4 in a row.
Yeah, I've got a bunch of 3s. To the last time I had ticked off Patriarchy Sucks, Indigenous Story directed by Sattler, acknowledges the pandemic, a middle-aged woman makes dubious sexual choices, and I think I have British World Dramatic Competition film, and I think I have crossed off 2 or 3 more since then.
Yeah, I'd had Rape Culture already, but you all have crossed that off now if you include Fair Play.
Yeah, Rape Culture, I think I crossed off for Fair Play, and I've crossed off First Feature by a Relatively Famous Actor, I saw Theatre Camp.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I couldn't even decide what counted for that.
I think that and Bad Behavior would count.
Yeah.
And then I could take off a Made and or Set in San Francisco Bay Area. Yeah. So, I mean, we've got a couple there.
Yeah. I mean, we haven't talked about them on this podcast yet, I don't think, but I've got Climate Change is Bad Doc and Climate Change is Bad Drama.
I haven't had any of those yet, but I've got some on my watch list.
I've seen 2 disability docs. We haven't talked about them yet, so I took off probably Ableist Disability Doc.
You've seen your biopic?
I have seen my biopic about a biopic and a doc about a famous person. That would be Cassandra, and also the Michael J. Fox film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've seen several Made and or Set in the SF Bay Area.
Mm-hmm. My surprising one was today. I managed to take off Incest twice.
Yeah.
But the first one was very surprising. I won't elaborate on this, but Polite Society, which is like a crowd pleaser movie that will probably be like rated like 12, has like it's an incredibly like incesty, like it's kind of the plot twist is very incesty, although there's still some like incesty dynamics that prelude the incesty plot twist, and I was really surprised that that was the film that allowed me to tick off the incest square, and then I guess you could tick it off with Eileen as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was a shock.
I sort of cheated because, well, I'm ticking off feminist horror film by a woman because I would say
feminist is in bracket, is in quotes, air quotes.
Because I think Cat Person is sort of trying to be a horror film. And also pod generation, if we take horror more generally and just sort of treat it as like genre, which a lot of people who are in the horror realm do, is they talk about horror, but like, or their publication is called horror, but really they mean like anything within the genre realm, then pod generation also counts. And both of those are feminist in quotes.
I've definitely like tried to avoid the horror films as much as possible this year because I don't trust Sundance horror programming.
Oh yeah, well I tried too and I still got 2 horror films.
I think I'll watch Infinity Pool, but I don't know yet if that's trying to be feminist or not.
Probably not.
And the one thing that I don't think I can like know if I can tick off until the end of the festival is Great Film Nobody Will See and Will Disappear.
Yeah.
I feel like by the end of the fest, I think I've got a few contenders, but by the end of the festival, I'll know what people have, like, forgotten about.
I'm pretty certain Slow is mine for that. I think no one's going to see that.
I think you're absolutely right. I think there are a few, like, I thought more people would be talking about A Still Small Voice, and yet I feel like nobody saw it. Like, there is stuff like that. But we'll see what wins awards, I suppose.
I think like even Fantastic Machine, I feel like nobody's talking about it, but it's going to Berlin, so it has a chance to not disappear.
Yeah, in fact, I'm going to tick off that square now because I really think you're right that nobody has seen Slow.
Yeah, and nobody is going to see it, no matter how loudly we shout about it.
Except the listeners of this podcast.
Yes, if
they are given an opportunity to do so.
Yeah. We're hoping you will be able to see it because it really was very good. Well, if you enjoyed this episode, our fifth episode of the Sundance 2023 podcast season, we recommend catching up with the first four episodes of the season. In our first episode, we preview the festival. The second one, we talk about the spotlight section at Sundance. In the third one, we talk about some of the highlights so far, including Slow and Fancy Dance. And in the fourth episode, we go deep on Indigenous films at the festival. So we recommend going back and checking those all out. Those are all free. A bunch of episodes have come up in our discussion today that you may be interested in. They are all members only, as are all of our episodes more than 6 months old, plus a smattering of members-only bonus episodes. So if you want to listen to those and also have access to our entire archive, plus all of our future episodes and the episodes we're doing now that will be locked in 6 months to members only, you can become a member at 7th-row.com/join. So the episodes we mentioned, and I'll put these in the links in the show notes as well, are our very first episode of the podcast, episode one, Leave No Trace, where we talk about Thomasin McKenzie's big breakout film, a really great film that also screened at Sundance. If you want to hear us talk more about AIDS depictions on screen that are better than Fairyland, you can check out episode 91. Where we do sort of a brief overview of AIDS on screen, dating back to the 80s and featuring the relatively new TV show It's a Sin. And we're joined on that episode by AIDS theater expert Dr. Emily Garside, who also joins us to help frame our discussion in episode 98, where we talk about two Angels in America productions, one being the Mike Nichols TV show and the other being the National Theater production, which has been recorded and you can actually watch now on NT at Home. Both really great in different ways. And if you want to be spared the trouble of watching The King, since Thomasin McKenzie is not in it very much and it is quite bad, but want to hear us say funny things about why it is so terrible, you can head back to episode 22, which we have appropriately titled The King Attempts to Adapt Shakespeare's Henry V. Again, to listen to all of those, become a member, 7th-row.com/join.
As we always ask, if you like this episode and like this podcast, please rate and review. We found it recently that in order for us to put our podcast episodes on Rotten Tomatoes, we need at least 200 ratings. And we are quite far from that. So we really, I think if you rate our podcast and it takes a couple seconds, you're really materially helping us to get the podcast in front of more people, which putting it on Rotten Tomatoes really helps to do. So that would be amazing if you could do that. And then if you really, really want to help us out, you could write us a review because it always makes our day. We love to read them. And you could also help us out by just sharing the Sundance season if you're enjoying it. Share it on social media, send it to a friend that you think might like it. We want to get this out there a little bit more. So that would be lovely.
And you can find all of the episodes of the season, the show notes, the bingo card, more info about the season, all at 7th-row.com/Sundance. And if you want updates on the podcast season delivered directly to your inbox, you can also subscribe to the newsletter at email.7th-row.com/Sundance23. We'll put links to those in the show notes. Orla, where can people find you?
You can find me at OrlaMango on Twitter, and you can find me at Orla_P_Smith on Instagram, and you can find me on this podcast.
And you can find me, Alex Heaney, on Twitter and Instagram at bwestcineast, bwestcineaste. You can find both of us on the 7th Row Twitter and Instagram account at 7th Row, SevenThrow. And of course, on this entire Sundance 2023 season. Four episodes previous, plus more episodes to come. So we hope you'll tune in. Thanks for listening.